surgery, and he's taking care of his wife, so he will be here this week.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and start. Our usual chair is on his way, but this is the committee on House Interim Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development, and we've got a pretty full agenda, but I think we can get through it this morning. So we'll go ahead and get started with the agenda. The first informational hearing, student loan refinance study report, House Bill 4021 from 2016. So Christian Maynard Phillips and Ben Cannon will come up. Oh, yeah, yeah. Good morning, and I don't know who's going to start first, but...
So, good morning, Vice Chair Gallegos and members of the committee. My name is Christian Maynard Phillip. I am the Policy Director for the Oregon State Treasury, and I am joined by my kind of colleague, Ben Cannon.
Yes, hi, I'm Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and Christian will do most of the presenting today, but I'll chime in a couple
Thanks.
Of minutes.
So, pursuant to House Bill 4021, we will be talking about our research regarding approaches to lowering the interest rates associated with student loans. So, to get started, I just really want to highlight trends in student loan borrowing because they really set the stage for our recommendations. So, as you all know, recently student loan debt topped $1.3 trillion. When we look at statistics in Oregon versus nationally, we see that the trends are pretty similar. For those graduating from a public or nonprofit private university with a four-year degree, about 63% of students are leaving school with debt, whereas nationally that number is about 68%. In Oregon, students leaving with debt have about $27,000 in student loan debt, whereas nationally that number is just over $30,000. So we understand and want to note that, yes, there is a proliferation of student debt, and this warrants policy attention. However, college is still a good investment. In fact, lifetime earnings associated with a student, or excuse me, associated with a degree have never been higher. Education debt correlates with education level attained. Higher levels of student debt are associated with higher earnings. When we look at the statistics, the top 25%, like the wealthiest 25% of student loan borrowers, hold 40% of all student loans, whereas the poorest 25% of student loan borrowers hold only 20% of student loans. With that being said, a student loan refinance program would disproportionately benefit higher earners. So we think that that's important to notate. Data indicates, in contrast, that there is an inverse relationship between borrowers' level of education and the likelihood of default. With that being said, the people we see defaulting are people with the lowest amounts of student loans, indicating, you know, perhaps they went to community college and didn't finish, and not only do they have not have improved job outcomes, but now they have this added student debt. So, moving along, I think it's really important to highlight federal repayment programs because 90% of all outstanding student loans are held by the federal government. I want to also highlight that these programs are really underutilized. They have some really attractive programs, such as for borrowers that are eligible for these programs, they can cap their monthly payments to a percentage of their discretionary income. The loan term is also extended, and anything left over at the end of the loan term is forgiven. So for the right borrower, this is a pretty attractive deal. As you probably heard, there are also some private refinance programs out there for students, but I really wanted to highlight that, or we wanted to highlight that they're largely cherry-picking high earners with very high credit scores. According to NerdWallet, a great resource for consumers, excellent credit is really anything over 720. So as you can see, the average scores, although these companies are largely void of any formal requirements, you know, these are pretty high average credit scores. You see the same thing with a lot of these state-run refinance programs. So again, high credit scores, the minimums are lower, but when we look at averages, these are quite high. So feasibility of a state-run refinance program. I really would also like to point out that many of the states that have student loan refinance programs had bond issuing entities that previously lent student loans. So it wasn't a huge jump to offer a student loan refinance program. As you know, Oregon does not have the same infrastructure, and that presents, you know, a lot more work to get such a program off the ground. As you know, due in part to our constitution and limits on general obligation bonds, we would likely utilize revenue bonds for such a program, and there are some barriers here. In utilizing revenue bonds, the revenue stream, or repaid refinanced loans from students, would be what would qualify for its own credit rating. Therefore, we'd have to be really thoughtful about who we're letting, you know, the eligibility requirements, because the riskier the portfolio and the credit scores underlying, you know, the portfolio, the more risk there would be to the program and the state. Second, such a program would have significant challenges in securing an interest rate low enough to provide a benefit to participants, which is essentially, you know, the whole reason we'd have such a program. So with that, I will turn it over to Ben for our recommendations and considerations.
Yeah, so this is just a quick wrap-up, and again, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HAC, and express my appreciation to Christian and the staff of the Treasury for working with us on this study and report. Also, on our team at the HAC, Susan Deegan in the Office of Student Access and Completion, who has over two decades of experience in state loans and grants and scholarship programs, was our principal lead on this work, and the result was a very comprehensive report that Treasury and our staff have put together, and we're giving you really just a snapshot of it today. But where I thought we would finish is just some of the policy considerations and recommendations for further research or consideration by our agencies as well as the legislature. As you've heard from Christian, there are significant challenges with what I think was anticipated or considered by the bill, which was a state loan program and state loan refinance program. But the report goes on to list some of the opportunities that we do think may be also available to the state and perhaps sort of lower cost or better value ways of creating options for better options for students. We note the very significant state contributions to scholarships and grants already, and indicate that these represent a high leverage way to decrease student debt upon completion or upon leaving college. We also note in the report the fact that some states offer work-study programs. The state of Oregon does not. Of course, there's a federal work-study program that many of our institutions participate in, but there is, we think, some value to considering work-study as a potential state-based investment in students, not only education, but also work experience. The report highlights some of the financial literacy programs that that state and school and students participate in. We call attention to one organization, SALT, that provides financial literacy education to students, believing that this represents a real fruitful way of helping students deal with the increasing student loan debt that they face and other financial literacy challenges. We draw attention to the opportunity that tax incentives can play and do play both at the federal and state level, and suggest that there may be ways of extending that policy to help support students. On the sort of more in the kind of loan financing portfolio, we do note the Oregon Capital Access Program, which is today a state program that is directed towards small business loans, but Treasury has suggested that there could be ways of extending that model, which really involves a public-private partnership, not a state loan reprogram, state loan sort of origination and financing program directly, but working with private lenders, adding some state dollars to help create lower interest options for students. So there could be some opportunity there. And finally, it would not be a heck report if it didn't emphasize the role that increasing degree completion plays in student financial well-being. And Christian alluded to some of the statistics about student borrowing and student debt. And there's a chart on the appendix. It's actually the last page of the printed report. And again, it's data that Christian alluded to at the outset, but it describes that the greatest levels of default, and this was probably the most striking piece of data that I've seen in the last year about student affordability of college. Student default rates are highest for students with the lowest level of debt. Okay, and they're lowest, student default rates are lowest for students with the highest amount of debt. It is totally counterintuitive at the first place. You'd think, gosh, these huge debt burdens, that must be where all the default is. The exact opposite is true. It's students with less than $5,000 of debt who are most likely to default. Why? Because many of those students have not completed their degree. They've taken out some debt. They maybe have attended a community college, a for-profit, wherever. They've not completed, and that debt becomes a real burden for them as a result of not having earned a degree or certificate, whereas those very large loan amounts often are associated with medical school, with law school, other professional school that confer degrees that result typically in better paying jobs. So I think that's really a sort of a key kind of data takeaway from this report, and suggests again why the legislature and our emphasis on degree completion is so very, very important. I think that's where we'll wrap up.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos. Thank you for this report. This is a very important work, and it, of course, is of high interest to lots of people, and it sounds like there may be a significant amount of misunderstanding as to where the issues actually lie from what I'm hearing you say. But one thing came clear to me as I was reading the report a couple of days ago, and it's a chart that's on page 6 of the comprehensive document, and it looks at the budget lifetime default rate, and it looks at the institutional categories and breaks them out separately. And it breaks out the two-year not-for-profit, four-year not-for-profit, then freshmen and sophomores, juniors and seniors, graduate students. But it also breaks out the two-year proprietary numbers, which stand in stark contrast to the others as being much higher. And this has been a problem for quite some time. I just wondered if in your analysis of I guess particularly involving how we educate students on being good consumers, that we continue to draw attention to the loan default rates for proprietary schools.
Mr. Chair, Representative McHugh, I'm happy to say that the commission is in the midst of adopting rules that will require many, if not all, of the schools that fall into that sector to provide for students a fact sheet at the time of enrollment that, among other things, carries this data, contains this data, so that students at the time of enrollment are have even more opportunity to be aware of some of the risks and history associated with borrowing for this sector. These numbers reflect, in part, the higher cost and the greater levels of borrowing associated with attending many of the two-year, many schools in that proprietary sector. So I think financial literacy is one strategy in the fact sheet that the commission is about to adopt as a requirement, as one strategy for bringing those numbers down.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cannon, do you have any data based on the, or that talks about the default rate based on what the field of study was?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, I cannot picture that data. We do have, we have seen some data that associates earnings to field of study, at least for, and this is state data that links employment department wage data to state data from the public systems of higher education. So we've done some of that analysis. I have not seen the default rate data associated with field of study. I don't know, Christian, whether you...
Yeah, Chair Reed, members of the committee, that's a great question. So previous to State Treasury, I worked at the U.S. Federal Department of the Treasury, and I worked on a series of research pilots in regards to financial literacy, and one big, really current administration effort was how do we give students these this market information so that they can make more informed decisions before taking out loans. So I know that there are efforts there, but I don't think that there is existing data.
Good. Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for the report. Thank you for the work. I'm sort of disappointed that part of your recommendations don't include working with the universities to reduce cost and to finish in 4 years. Hope you can include that in the plan, research plan. Also, I'd like to see the financial literacy first before we start working scholarship grants, if that's, and all that, and make it even like a checklist or a, for that end that you did SALT. I just think that we need to be sure that our young people, and not just young people, anyone applying or wanting to go into debt for that much, get the financial literacy and the SALT presentation before they start down this path, and including information like we talked about, is which degrees and what's your potential earnings. It's a, you know, it's a big stake, and people don't understand, you know, interest, how it compounds, and that your, you know, your $100,000 loan can be $200 or whatever payback. So I would encourage the people working on the, and I didn't read the report. When are you anticipating a plan or some actions?
Representative Wisnett, this report is delivered in response to House Bill 4021 and its requirement that we bring back a study and recommendations to the legislature, look to the chair and other members of this committee to consider next steps.
So this might be a chance for me to jump in. My apologies, first off, for being late. There's some challenges with dealing with a sick kid. The bill was intended just to do the study. One thing, and maybe you already talked about before I got here, Representative Rayfield has indicated an interest in presenting some legislation that builds on the material here. So it'll be up to all of you in the next legislative session to determine what happens from that.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Other questions or comments? Again, my apologies for being late. Thank you for the presentation. And so, Christian, I think you're done for now. Ben, you get to stay for our next item. I'm sure you already talked about how busy our agenda is here, so we'll be moving quickly. Great.
Again, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HAC. And another Oregon Promise update, but this one with some new data. It is now the end of the fall term, and as a result, we have data from the fall term of the Promise to report. Before I get into that, just some quick background information. I include these in part because I know these presentations get out to a public audience, so your committee doesn't require the background, but here it is. Senate Bill 81 passed in 2015 to create free or nearly free community college tuition for eligible students. provides coverage of most of tuition costs for up to 90 credits, which is the equivalent of 2 years full-time enrollment. It's designed to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for high school graduates or recent high school graduates. Very importantly, of course, this program is available just to high school, recent high school grads or GED recipients who have enrolled very quickly within a community college. That period, that time period within which they had to enroll was 12 months in the initial year, the fall 2016 enrollments. It will now move to a six-month requirement. They have to have had a minimum 2.5 GPA in high school or the equivalent on GED. They have to complete a FAFSA or its alternative and accept any state or federal grant. There are requirements for maintaining the grant, including being enrolled at least half time, which is defined as 6 credits per term, making satisfactory academic progress, completing a first year experience, and paying a $50 per term copay. You know that the awards are calculated as a last dollar approach, where the state investment through the Oregon Promise is designed to cover the difference between state and federal grants that they've received and tuition costs at the community college. Here's how that looks. This is a slightly different view of slides you've seen before that show at different income levels what a student will receive in state and federal grant money. I'll use this acronym EFC, Expected Family Contribution, which is a proxy for financial need. Low expected financial contribution means high need on the part of the student as determined by the FAFSA. High EFC means less need. This is looking at students and family income from a sort of low to high as you go from left to right. A very low income student and their family would qualify on a per term basis. This is now for just a single term, assuming they took 12 credits, for almost a $2,000 Pell Grant, almost $700 Opportunity Grant, and the Oregon Promise Award would be that $1,000 minimum that you all put within the bill, prorated. So we're now talking about a single term, so that's a third of a thousand, that's $333 or $334, minus the $50 copay. We've worked the copays in through reducing their state award by $50. You can see that's at the lowest income level. Students with slightly lower Pell Grants have sort of similar situation. But then once you get into a higher family income, you see the award sizes diminish on Pell, but increase on the Opportunity Grant, on the Oregon Promise, until you reach that higher EFC, where students are qualified for the full Oregon Promise Award, which caps at about $1,083 per term for a full-time student. We publicized this program in a variety of ways over the last year, and now into some of the data. So this is, we call this our application funnel. There were about 35,000 high school graduates in 2016. Now, this is an estimate. ODE has not published their high school graduation data, and it does not include, even as an estimate, it doesn't include our private high school or GED completers who are also eligible. So take that sort of red bar as just some background information. We had almost 20,000 applicants, but that included people who were not in. They simply weren't eligible. It included people like me who just wanted to get online and try it and were rejected as not being a recent high school or GED graduate. Then this filter, we applied these filters. We got down to about 14,000 applicants who met the high school and GED and residency requirement. Then about 10,500 who met that requirement in the purple bar and also submitted a valid FAFSA that was accepted. It was a valid means the federal government had sort of validated it, and it listed an Oregon Community College. And we awarded 6,745 Oregon Promise Awards this fall. So that's that blue bar, or that blue triangle at the bottom, is our actual fall disbursements that have been made over the last few weeks. They were made to students really at the outset of the term, but our office has been processing those really up until the last few days.
What made the difference between the 10,000 and the 6,700? All the others make sense to me intuitively.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very important question. Those 6,745 showed up and enrolled half-time. So in every bar above that, these are students who had expressed some interest or had some eligibility. The 6,745 actually enrolled at a community college for at least 6 credits this fall.
One other clarification question. Yeah. Sorry, Representative Wisdom, please.
A lot of work. I mean, Director, that's a lot of work. I'm impressed, and it's, I think everyone supports on this committee supports that program. How many man hours are, you know, do you have, is it gonna, are you gonna be able to handle this without additional FTEs or?
Representative Wisdom, Chair Reed, I have to say our Office of Student Access and Completion, I mentioned Susan Deegan in our last presentation, she and her colleagues have done an extraordinary job running a brand new program in the, getting it up and running within, you know, weeks of the bill passing, to open an application, to establish this process with very little additional FTE. We there are a variety of reasons we were kind of able to do that, and one of the most significant is the very extraordinary work that and effort that they put in. We also had some systems that we were able to take advantage of that are we use for other scholarships and awards, but this this has been a huge undertaking. We're still learning, and in our I should have said at the outset, the report I'm giving today will be followed by a formal report to the legislature on evaluation report that takes a lot of this data and puts it in written form in order to meet the Senate Bill 81 requirement that we submit an interim evaluation to the legislature by December 31st of 2016. So that's forthcoming. This is a preview of that. The slide here notes the roughly 1,000 students who had applied, were eligible, listed, you know, listed an Oregon community on their community college on their FAFSA, but enrolled in a public university instead. So key questions. Here's what we're going to try to answer in this presentation as well as our subsequent report to you. Number one, has the promise changed Oregon High School's high school graduates' enrollment in higher education? Are we actually influencing decisions by high school, recent high school graduates? Number two, who is participating in the Oregon Promise? Who are these students? And number three, want to talk a little bit about the costs associated with implementing it this year now that we have the first term data. So we'll start with number one and impact on enrollment decisions. So, okay, we are doing a year, a comparison here between two different cohorts. 2014, and these are students who graduated high school in 2014, and 2016, students who graduated high school in 2016. Now, there are some significant differences between these data sets that are described in the notes, and I can get into in more detail. For now, I think it's important simply to understand that these are this is a comparison with caveats because of some data limitations. We're doing our best to try to answer this question of impact with data sets that are imperfect in their ability to compare. But we wanted to give you at least some initial thoughts about the impact. So from that 2014 data set, so these are public high school graduates. There were about 35,000 of them in 2014. We found 5,700 of them had enrolled at a community college in the fall of 2014 carrying at least 6 credits. I want to note, this includes some students who would not have been eligible for the promise. They did not have a 2.5 GPA. They hadn't submitted a FAFSA. It was every 2014 public high school graduate who had enrolled in a community college that fall. Move ahead 2 years, 2016. Now the promise is in place. Again, we've estimated, and I really want to underscore, this is just a sort of flatline estimate of the number of public high school graduates. ODE doesn't publish this until late January, so we're in the estimation business here. And we found 6,553 of them had enrolled in community college, 6 credits or more, on the promise. Okay, so that means they had to have a 2.5 GPA, they had to do a FAFSA, they got all the way through that funnel. So these are Oregon Promise students on the right. It is almost certainly the case, it is certainly the case, there are more members of the high school class of 2016 in community college than the 6553 who are promised recipients. There are students who did not qualify for the promise who nevertheless enrolled in a community college this fall without the award. But this is our kind of best way at this moment in time of trying to compare what the impact of the promise has been. And you can see in the final row here, again, very rough estimate of the increased percentage of the high school class of recent high school graduates who have enrolled in a community college that following fall.
So I want to make sure I understood something you said earlier, that 6,500 is an estimate. Does also include people who are not benefiting from the Oregon Promise but are enrolled? Is that right?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, no. Those 6553 are only limited to Oregon Promise recipients. Because we don't have the ODE high school graduation data, and we don't yet as a state have a longitudinal data system, until we get that file with those names, we can't link it with our community college data. So we actually don't know how many additional members of the high school class of 2016 are enrolled in a community college this fall.
So as you continue to refine that, is there going to be a possibility of getting a little more information of that in that category to determine, for example, I'm sure there's at least a few people who were prompted to explore community college by the Oregon Promise, and even though they weren't eligible, you could make some connection to their presence there and the promise?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, absolutely yes. And by getting the additional data and by bringing to bear some of the qualitative work that we've done on the promise, surveys of students and counselors, high school teachers, we believe it will be possible to provide that type of answer. I expect this number will rise, maybe 7,000 members of the high school class of 2016 who enrolled, so maybe more. Once you include those who did not get the promise award, but as you say, may have been prompted by the existence of the promise to explore community college.
Great. Thank you. Any questions?
One of the questions the legislation asks us to examine is the impact of the promise on public universities. And again, we're in very early stages, as are they, in considering the answer to that. But we do have fall enrollment at public universities. This slide expresses fall enrollment at each of the seven public universities, and then total, that's the black bar at the top, is all of them combined, as a percentage of recent high school graduates. Again, so sort of out of that high school class of 2016, we estimated on this slide that 18.5% of them enrolled in a community college. We estimate on this slide that 17.6% of that high school class of 2016 enrolled in a public university this fall. Again, an estimate because of because we don't yet have the ODE data, but it's in the ballpark. Mm-hmm. What that overall number could obscure are some changes at the institutional level, which is including potentially more significant effects at for particular institutions, which is what we will get at in the lower numbers here, or the lower lines here that are institution specific. I would note, there is a drop. That 18.3 to 17.6 is a non-trivial drop. It's several hundred students, probably fewer students from 2016 who enrolled in a Oregon public university versus 2015. If you look at the difference between 2013 and 2014, it was also about 0.6%, which is close to the 0.7% that we experienced in the last year. And that, of course, was without an Oregon Promise being created. So this drop of 0.7% is notable, but also not unique or unprecedented when it comes to changes in the decisions of high school graduates. Now, this slide is different. This is total fall enrollment. So now we're not talking. This doesn't look at recent high school graduates alone. It looks at overall fall enrollment: returning adults, non-traditional students, sophomores, juniors, seniors, etc. I haven't labeled the community colleges. They're There are 17 of them, of course. It's really just designed to give you the overall impression of enrollment trends at public universities and community colleges. You can see, partly as a result of the improving economy, the diminishing enrollment at in both sectors. Key question number two, who are these participants in the Oregon Promise? So sort of as it relates back to the last slide, well, Oregon Promise students are a small minority of total community college students. We think it's important to continue to point out that the vast majority of community college students do not qualify for the Oregon Promise. They are not recent high school, they're not sort of immediately recent high school graduates, or for other reasons are not qualified for the Promise. Those 6,745 this fall comprise about 5.5% of all community college students. Here are the numbers by college. I haven't put the overall enrollment or some way of trying to get a sense of, you know, do these match the scale or size of the colleges, although obviously in some respects they do. PCC is our largest college by far, and it has by far the most Oregon Promise recipients. Chemeketa is number two. There's some challenges with putting sort of overall FTE on this as well, in part because some colleges really have more programming geared towards returning adults than others, so that could sort of skew those. But generally, we believe that the program reached all parts of the state, students at every college, and there's certainly a relationship here between the size of the college and the number of Oregon Promise recipients. We'll do further evaluation of that. Who are these students in terms of income? So we've sort of cut them up into four different categories here, with lower income students on the left and higher income students on the right, based on their eligibility for the Pell Grant. So students in the far left-hand green bar are eligible for a full Pell Grant as a result of their low income. You see then moderate Pell, low Pell, and no Pell. This is the breakdown of those 6,745 students based on their Pell Grant status. Community college students generally in Oregon, it's about 50-50. 50% qualify for a Pell of some sort, 50% do not.
Can you remind us where the cutoff is for the for Pell eligibility, please?
Yes. So the cutoff is at an expected family contribution of $5,235 is where you are no longer eligible for a Pell. To translate that into adjusted gross income is not straightforward, but I will try, because it depends on the number of dependents, whether you have a second kid in college, assets. But you know, if you look online for a table of how expected family contribution, or Pell, relates to adjusted gross income, for a family with two dependents, you would no longer qualify for any Pell grant. So you'd be sort of between the blue and the red bars here at an adjusted gross income of somewhere around $55,000 for the family. So these red, the red bar here, again, it's very rough because the Pell is not awarded on the basis of adjusted gross income, but we could roughly say you could think of those families as being sort of $60,000 and above of adjusted gross income. Again, that's two dependents, maybe one kid in college, sort of modest assets.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Now, Oregon Promise recipients by race ethnicity. So again, this is the 6,745. Here, what we've done in the middle category, that's the percent of that, those fall enrollees who are within each race and ethnic category. And then I've compared it to the percent of the Oregon senior class, 12th high school seniors, 12th graders in 2015-16. So the this Oregon Promise fall class is a diverse class, and the percentage of non-white students roughly mirrors the percentage of non-white students who were Oregon high school seniors last year. That said, there are some non-trivial differences between the two columns for particular groups, especially the first two categories there, the African American or Black and the American Indian Alaskan Native category, where they are underrepresented as Oregon Promise recipients versus within the 12th grade class.
Okay.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, it's an observation. I mean, it's just interesting, and I'm not sure why, but all of the groups have a downward trend except for the white. It increases in terms of the percentage rate of recipient. It's just interesting.
And Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos, we'll do further work again with ODE data. We can make this a better comparison by dealing with this unknown category. We've got some differences still in the classifications that we think we can resolve over the next month or two. We were interested in how many of the Oregon Promise students had experienced some dual credit in high school. So this is the percentage of the Oregon Promise recipients this fall who were actually in our community college data system because they had registered in dual credit through a community college as high school juniors or seniors. You see that nearly 40% of them had earned dual credit as a high school senior at a community college. Finally, what will be the cost to the state of implementing the Oregon Promise in 2016-17? This has been a popular program, and as a result, it will it is costly to the state. We were awarded or appropriated about $10 million for scholarships this fall. On this slide, what we've done is used a couple of assumptions. One is a retention assumption. These fall enrollees will continue to be eligible for the award, assuming they make satisfactory academic progress, and they continue to enroll in college for winter and spring. And so we've applied an 82%, which is what we think when we looked at that 2014 cohort of recent high school graduates. It's about how many of them were retained at halftime or more, term to term. So using that assumption, you'll see the breakdown of costs. We will award a little over $4 million this fall in scholarships, in grants to Oregon Promise grants. With the 82% rate, we would award $3.6 million in the winter and $2.9 million in the spring. Which would require a total of $10.9 million for the 2016-17 school year. Obviously, with a $10 million appropriation and $10.9 million in projected awards, we may have a challenge, and that's something that we will continue to work on understanding better and addressing with the legislature if necessary in order to ensure that students who qualify for this award this year receive it if eligible for the duration of the 2016-17 academic year. This goes a little bit back to the income-based slide. There's a lot on here, but I'll try to break it down quickly. If you take all of those about 6,800 Oregon Promise recipients and you divide them.
Sorry to interrupt for just 1 second. Representative McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Mr. Cannon, could you go back a slide? Is that spring of 2018 correct?
I'm sorry. That is a typo. That is, should be, say the spring
so
of
2017. It is just the 2 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good catch.
Good catch.
Thank you.
So if we break the if you take this, the 6,800 Oregon Promise fall recipients, and you line them up from lowest EFC, meaning highest need, to highest EFC, most affluent, lowest need, if you put them all in a line, and then you divided that line into equal fifths, those are the quintiles, I've done that here with the lowest fifth, those are the highest need students in the first row, and down so on into the fifth quintile, which are the highest need students, the most affluent students. And you see the range of their expected family contribution. So that top 20%, those are students whose expected family contribution is close to $20,000 or above. And then you see where the state dollars are going. And I mean, this question arose a lot during the legislative debate around the Oregon Promise. And so we've reported back to you now on sort of where the dollars, the state dollars, are applied. It is sort of built into the design of a last dollar program that the state dollars for the program are concentrated on students who have less eligibility for the federal grant, the Pell Grant, and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and that's reflected in the proportion of Oregon promised state funding that these income quintiles receive. So this is really a summary of some key findings. Number one, has the promise changed Oregon high school graduates' enrollment patterns in higher education? We note that it appears that a larger percentage of recent high school graduates enrolled in a community college, a slightly smaller percentage enrolled in a public university, although we're not prepared to say that that's the direct result of the promise, but it could have been impacted by the promise. These conclusions still require additional data and validation. Question two, who is participating in the promise and who is not? We note that about half, a little less than half, of the Oregon Promise recipients come from lower income families. That is, they're not eligible for a Pell Grant, and about half do not. And because it is a last dollar program, most Oregon Promise state funding goes to recipients with higher incomes. Total participation and cost, we note here, the $4.4 million in scholarship funding for the fall. There are some additional research questions here. Retention and attainment, the goal of the program is not merely to ensure that students or help students to enroll, but hopefully to help them complete. There are additional state investments in advising, first-year experience programs, and other retention activities, and we certainly will be watching very closely how many of the students retain and complete equity, and then some of the remaining financial considerations that we need to deal with. And that really, yes, that is all of it.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, please.
Mr. Reed, thank you for your presentation. One of the things that I was interested in, I think some of the committee members were interested in, is overall what kind of drawdown or what kind of additional resources come to the state of Oregon through financial aid. If you have 53%, which is a higher number than I expected, of people that don't qualify for any financial aid, and you have 47% accepting some, is the return on that, my guess would be that'd be around $15-16 million if you take the 47% and apply a $5,000 financial aid on average drawdown for those students that do get it. Is that $15 million to $10 million within a range that you expected, or can you speak to the amount of financial aid brought in for these students? Is that in with kind of the thought that we were hoping to have happen?
Representative Hayden, Representative Reed, I don't have a definitive answer to your question, but it's a really good one and one that we will be looking at. I can say this, and I reported it last time to you, that Oregon saw an 11% increase in the number of high school students who completed a FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid that is the basis for receiving a Pell Grant. That was the largest increase in the country by far. In fact, nationally, the country was down. There were a lower percentage of 2016 high school students did a FAFSA than 2015. In Oregon, we were up 11%. That almost certainly is largely attributable to the Oregon Promise and its requirement of completing a FAFSA. That suggests that we are bringing more Pell dollars into the state, but we've not been able to analyze the 2016 high school cohort against the 2015 or 14 cohorts to see whether the Pell drawdown is greater, whether we brought in more Pell through that class than in prior ones. But I think the data here suggests that there likely has been some of that impact. And you're right, for that 46% that's Pell eligible, primary source of their Oregon Promise Award is the Pell Grant. Right, and I think a really key question is whether those students would have gone anyway, or whether it was the existence of the Oregon Promise that got them to complete the FAFSA, made them eligible for a Pell Grant, and they said, "Great," right? And it would not, if not for the Oregon Promise, that may not have occurred. We can't answer that question with as much confidence or precision yet as we would like, but I hope by the time session starts, really February, we'll have a more confident answer to that question.
I like the way you asked that question. I like the way you said it, too, because the other interesting detail will, of course, be the people who were prompted to fill out the FAFSA and then maybe went to a university as opposed to a community college and still got the Pell Grant.
Right.
Representative McKeown, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Mr. Cannon, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for your work on this. I guess the question I would have is, what impact, or do we see an impact with the correlation on the opportunity, pressure on the opportunity grant because more students are filing a FAFSA? Is there information there that would be helpful for us to have as well?
Representative McKeown, I'm going to look at Susan. It's not a question that I've at least taken up directly. Our opportunity grant participation rates and expenditure rates are in line with our expectations and budgets for this biennium. But I agree, it's something we will need to take into consideration.
Thank you. Representative Wizard, you had something to
say? Yes, thank you. Director Cannon, you're going to meet with Representative Beretta this week, I think, about a waiver to the enrolling within 6 months, and I support that. I think the program he's going to ask you about is FFA, ambassadors, and there may be illnesses, too. Someone has a short-term illness that prevents them or something, so I think there should be some waivers, and I'd support that. I think everyone would.
Thank you. As we transition, I'll just make one comment, which, of course, I'm interested in watching all of you expand the eligibility without a waiver, but just going further than that, saying when we can afford it. 6 months seems arbitrary to me, but I won't be here. So thank you very much for that. And again, don't go anywhere, because you're up next as well.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we're
ready to move on. Yes, please.
I will be briefer in this section. I was asked by the committee to, and again, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, to speak briefly to efforts that Oregon public campuses are making to address issues of student harassment. I am not in a position today to provide you with sort of a comprehensive catalog of ways, the myriad ways that Oregon public universities and community colleges address student harassment. But I can describe some examples, bring some examples of that, and speak very briefly to the issue. If there are questions about either specific incidents of harassment or specific policies or programs, those questions would be best addressed to specific campuses that are responsible for those policies and programs. The Higher Education Commission does not, of course, govern our public universities or community colleges. It's not responsible directly for the policies or programs that they adopt related to harassment. And while our commission has adopted a statement of support for the student equity and student safety work that our colleges and universities are doing, we do relatively little directly to impact those practices or policies. So I'm here primarily in a sort of reporting role and not in a directive one in any respect. But I will note just a couple of things. On the topic of harassment and discrimination generally, I think it is safe to say that all of our public universities and community colleges have codes and policies that address this issue. So, for example, a student conduct code, and I will quote from the Oregon Institute of Technology, Oregon Tech, that prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender, race, age, veteran status, sexual orientation, national origin, religion, or qualifying disability. It prohibits harassment, threats or bullying, sexual harassment, retaliation, and a category of other activities that are prohibited, and students can be disciplined as a result of violation of that policy. And that sort of policy approach is undergirds the approach that our all of our campuses take to harassment issues generally. Our colleges and universities, though, typically go above and beyond creating policies and codes and processes for discipline with respect to harassment. They, in many cases, have programs that deal directly with issues of harassment and bias. And again, just to cite a couple of examples, but not to give anything close to a comprehensive report on that, the University of Oregon operates a respect website where students and staff can report incidents of bias, discrimination, or discriminatory harassment. They, along with OSU and potentially other institutions, have a bias response team. In the UVA's case, it's called a bias education response team that responds to incidents reported by students, that helps provide education to the campus related to issues of bias and harassment. The University of Oregon has a Center for Multicultural Academic Excellence, which is a hub really for student meetings and student support, particularly multicultural students, around these types of issues. Our community colleges, much the same, many of the same types of activities. I'd note some of the efforts that Mount Hood Community College has made just over the last couple of months to create space for students to discuss and describe issues of concern related to harassment and other forms of discrimination on campus, an open forum. They've developed put out welcoming placards and signs around campus that try to provide students with a greater sense of security and belonging. Finally, I would note that many of our institutions, and again, I don't have a precise number, but the presidents of many of our public institutions have, in the last month, reaffirmed their campuses' commitment to diversity, respect, and inclusivity in the wake of significant student concern resulting from perceived or actual threats to their safety and security. And so, just to name a few, Eastern Oregon University, Oregon State University, Chemeketa Community College, Mount Hood Community College, University of Oregon, Columbia Gorge Community College, Lynn Benton Community College, Portland State University, whose presidents have reminded their campus and reinforced the values of diversity, respect, and inclusivity on their campuses with a belief shared by the Higher Education Commission that a diverse and safe campus environment is one that's conducive to learning. And respect and appreciate the very significant efforts that our and leadership that our presidents have shown in recent weeks and months in this regard.
Thank you for the update. Any questions?
Yeah, I just want to comment. I really appreciate the Street Cannon's presentation, and I just believe that it's important for the legislature to be on record recognizing that this discussion is going on across the country in terms of on campuses across the country. And I've actually participated in two discussions on two different campuses recently, trying to address, you know, how can we better address the issues of safety and with regard to discrimination, whether it's sexual abuse, all kinds of things. And I think that, as I said, it's a discussion that's going on, and I think it's important for the legislature to also sort of acknowledge that discussion. One thing I would mention, though, is that what the heck, we've got the diversity lens, and I think that's an important tool. But I think we'll hear in a little bit about more about cultural competency. But one of the principles of cultural competency is that it's one thing to be sensitive to cultural issues, discrimination, et cetera, but it's a whole nother thing to do something about it. And I think that's where we need to really focus on as we move forward in terms of implementing this diversity lens and so on. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gallegos, for raising it and keeping our attention to it. If there's not anything else, we will thank you again, Mr. Cannon. And we'll jump around a little bit now and head off to the innovation plan. Heather Stafford, I assume Dr. Flynn might be joining her too, it looks like. Very good. So as you get started, we remember a committee, we heard a preliminary update at a previous meeting. Honestly, I don't remember how long ago it was we heard that, but now we get to hear a progress report and the current status of the innovation plan. Ms. Stafford, please.
For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon and live in Portland, serve the state. It's a pleasure to be here and give you an update, and I'll let Erin introduce herself.
Hello, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Erin Flynn. I serve as the chair of the Oregon Innovation Council, as well as the Associate Vice President for Strategic Partnerships at Portland State University. Pleased to be here this morning to provide an update on our activities. Do we turn this? Okay. So what we'd like to do, Heather and I would like to share with you the progress we've made this year on strategic alignment and what we call Oregon Inc. 2.0. We want to thank you for your continued support of the Oregon Innovation Council and its work. The Oregon Innovation Council and the Signature Research Centers were established nearly 12 years ago now and have really become a national model for how states support innovation and entrepreneurship in target industries at the state level. So just as a reminder, the vision of Oregon Inc. is to build long-term strategies to innovate Oregon's target industries by making short-term catalytic investments that most directly and collaboratively create industry competitive advantage through disruptive...
Just a second. I think you are a little close to the microphone, and it's distorting the recording a little bit.
Sorry.
So it's kind of counterintuitive, but move it a little bit away, it'll work.
A little bit away.
Better.
Okay,
yes.
Usually
thank
it's
you.
The opposite, right?
Right. Thank you.
So Oregon Inc. has been an extremely successful program, really seeking to commercialize innovation out of our research universities. And it's been a collaborative effort between our public research universities, our entrepreneurs, our technology transfer offices, and generated significant economic growth for our state. So what we're primarily here to do today is to share with you some of the changes that we're anticipating in the program and some organizational, what we call realignment, that's taking place in the program. And Heather's going to provide some of the details on that. But as the chair of the council and as an individual who's been deeply engaged in innovation and entrepreneurship in our state for over a decade, I want to just take a moment to share with you why we're taking a deep look at the program and considering some changes to its structure. Number one, since the Innovation Council was started over a decade ago, we've really seen remarkable changes in our state in terms of innovation and entrepreneurship. We've really seen the blossoming of our entrepreneurial and startup community. When the Oregon Inc. Council began, there were two accelerators in our state. Today, there are dozens of accelerators. At the time the council started, the technology transfer functions of our universities were nascent. Some of them did not yet exist. They're much more mature today. The technology transfer function of all of our public research universities are now mature and producing significant results. So there's been a big shift in the ecosystem, and as a result of that, the state of Oregon and Business Oregon decided 2 years ago to create a division specifically dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship, and that's the division that Heather runs along with her team. That was a recognition of the significance of entrepreneurship and startup activity to our state's economy. So one of the drivers of this realignment is really to look at how is the state now organized around entrepreneurship, startups, and innovation? What's happened in the larger innovation ecosystem in our state? And what is the appropriate role for state investment today, given this changed, more robust, more dynamic environment? So that's sort of number one in terms of context setting for our work. The second point that I want to emphasize is that the budget for Oregon Inc. is now part and parcel of the base budget of Business Oregon, which has given the board of Oregon Inc. More discretion in terms of how we think about the highest and best use of those dollars. So that's something that we've taken on as a board, is to really think through at this time, given the changes I just described, what is the best way to move forward. And then finally, because the program has been around for a decade, it's really important to take a fresh look at what's happening in industry. And one of the biggest changes we've seen in industry is this sort of mashup or merging, if you will, of different industries because of the pervasiveness of digital and electronic media, the way that all industries from healthcare to manufacturing are basically being totally transformed through computing. So we no longer have sort of the siloed industry structure that we have historically in the past, and that changes how we think about industry and signature research centers and what they represent. So with that as sort of context setting for where we're headed, I'm going to turn it over to Heather. I do just want to note that the name of Business Oregon's strategy today is Grow Our Own, and that is a clear recognition that economic growth in our state will largely be the result of growing our own companies and nurturing our own small companies, which will be our next large companies. And that's really the heart and soul of the Oregon Innovation Council and its work.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I'll take over a little bit here. We did recognize at Business Oregon, and this was actually before my time, it was led to the creation of the Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, but that more than 70% of the jobs that Oregon was creating were coming from companies who already call Oregon home. So it's a good place to put our bets. 82% of those companies actually employ less than 9 employees. So the vast majority of our business constituents, are very, very small businesses. And so we took a look last year. Our economic strategies and policy team took a look at what Oregon's industries were, and I think I may. Oh, that was it. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to silo industries, where before you could say we're doing something with semiconductors and we're doing something with clean tech, we're doing something with bio. Those are increasingly, the lines are being blurred with, and these are some examples of those types of technologies. So unmanned aerial vehicles or unmanned systems or drones, for instance, are very difficult to silo into. Are they hardware? Is there cybersecurity? Is it analytics? Is it data? All of those things, is it sensors? And then when you get to the point of application, they have wide-ranging applications from defense to agriculture to firefighting and to weather prediction and on and on and on. So in that environment, how do we at the state level make decisions on what we're going to support? And it's been a very interesting, lots of conversations at the board level trying to wrap our arms around that, as is the whole world. We're not alone in this in this endeavor. So this slide is intentionally left blank because, you know, we are in a situation where the Oregon Innovation Council and the wonderful board members who are leading that, along with Business Oregon and many of our statutory partners that are on that board as well, are looking into the future, trying to make some decisions, trying to predict the future, trying to be futurists in an era that is that looks sort of like this. So we do have some strategies, and the board has put some policies and direction into place that we want to share with you on how we expect to navigate this this unknown terrain. Innovation and entrepreneurship, from our perspective, we focus on three primary things in my office, which is to foster innovation and to create more and better entrepreneurs and increase access to capital. So the structure I'll show you now is a reflection of that, and it's a little wordy, and I won't go through every single word, but the top represents the state-level office. So my team, there's only 5 of us at Business Oregon in the Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Scholarship, and we focus on strategic alignment of the programs that we have and new programs and identifying gaps to fill. We do scopes of work and contracts, metrics and reporting. We manage a couple of different boards, Oregon Innovation Council and the Oregon Growth Board, and we are working on vision and values and branding, communication, and we work with all of you on legislation and policy, as well as the governor's office. Under that, the bodies of work split into innovation, capital, and working with the ecosystem. And on the innovation side, that's where Oregon Innovation Council is our primary think tank or board. And we manage, through that, the signature research centers. We coordinate with the four Tier 1 university R&D offices to look at what their capabilities are and match those up with industry. We do a program with SBIR, STTR, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end, that we've been piloting over the last year and a half. And then these high-impact opportunity programs. We create alignment as much as possible with the STEM and CTE work and Talent Council and Workforce, so that we're creating a real pipeline of alignment on what are we innovating and do we have the workforce that we're going to need for that as we proceed.
So that's an overview of the new division, which Heather oversees. And I guess actually going back to this slide, so the challenge in the work of the board of Oregon Inc. has really been, again, to determine how to best deliver on the innovation agenda, given this new structure and given the pretty dramatic changes that are happening in the industry landscape, as Heather and I both noted, as well as determining what's the appropriate role for state dollars in this changed and more sophisticated and mature environment of innovation and startups. These are sort of several of the key tenets that the board has come up with as we move forward. Number one, there has been a process over the years, in addition to the three signature research centers that make up the bulk of the work of the council, a process of receiving applications and responding to those. And those have resulted in industry initiatives like SOAR, like Drive Oregon and OWET. One of the key changes that we propose to make is to move from a reactive to a proactive strategy. So really getting clearer about what the opportunities are for innovation in the state and going after those and seeking out skilled folks in the public and private sector who can identify and deliver on those opportunities rather than simply responding to what comes to us.
Can I test something in that category, though? One of the things I think the legislature has always liked about Oregon Inc. is the openness to new ideas. So I'm going to try putting a few words in your mouth and seeing if I'm right on this, that within those identified opportunities areas of competitive advantage, the council is still going to be open to ideas that fit in that. Is that true?
Absolutely. The council would never, I think, try to prescribe innovation because, one, it's not appropriate, right. And we really are looking to private partners, research universities to bring forth the best ideas. But the idea here is to have parameters, right? So it's parameters. It's identifying what data and experts suggest are the highest impact areas where we already have competitive assets and advantages that can be accelerated by investment through Oregon Inc. So it's really about putting some parameters around that innovation. And yes, within those parameters, the council will still be very open and looking for the best proposals.
Thanks.
So I hope that clarifies that. Okay. And so that's really the second point, to leverage inherent strengths with unique impact in three or four areas where the council, along with expert advisors, have identified that we have unique capabilities and strengths that are not easily replicable in other metropolitan regions. right? That's the key to competitiveness. What do we have here that's unique in our universities, in our private sector, and what can the state do to accelerate innovation in those areas? That sort of acceleration, that catalytic activity is what Oregon Inc. and the state, we believe, should be funding, right? And short bursts of activity that get us to the next stage of development quickly. Now, one of the things that we know has happened over time with Oregon Inc. is that while sort of the original vision was around upstream innovation, how do you take primary kind of research that's happening in universities and move it through the innovation and commercialization pipeline, Oregon Inc. moved more downstream to commercialization and building entrepreneurial companies through the Signature Research Centers and its fund. That's really important, and we want to continue to fund that. That would be more at the 2- and 5-year level, but we also want to be thinking long-term and moving upstream with some of the investment. So looking at a 2-year, 5-year, and 10-year timeline. Guiding principles for investment moving forward. There's a strong desire that all awards be made competitively and equitably, making sure that all proposals are able to come to the table within those parameters and be evaluated fairly. One of the main changes, and this has, I think, clear consensus on the board, as well as at Business Oregon, is that Oregon Inc. was never intended to fund organizations in perpetuity. And so to move out of the business of organizational operations over time toward these high-impact investments is a direction that we're moving in. Another key change is to move to a centralized fund. In past years, each Signature Research Center has had its own commercialization fund. We don't believe this is an efficient way to be organized. There's potentially duplication of effort through that approach. The idea of a single fund, I think, gains us significant efficiencies. Also, because of the blurring of industry boundaries and lines, a single fund makes a lot more sense. And there's a good consensus that that's an important direction. And I already mentioned the high impact opportunities that we'll be proactively seeking the best ideas from our public and private partners.
So to that end, the Signature Research Centers have been a core foundation of these investments for going on 12 years. And so we'd like to share with you a little bit how what we've asked them. We've been working with them, with the council, on identifying where a lot of that value has been created. There's been some amazing results. The predictions that Dave Chen and Rick Warren and many of the people in the very beginning of this actually made, that the commercialization cycle would be long and that these were longer term investments, is starting to really show. And we will have a lot of graphs and other things to share with you as soon as we have all the data in, because we're always a quarter or so behind. But just for example, the way that we calculate jobs is very, very conservative. Over the 5 years, Oregon Inc., which we calculate W-2 full-time, full wage, fully loaded jobs for very early stage science companies, was 476. Over 5 years, and just got our numbers in for 2016, excuse me, and it's 326 just for this year. So if you think about what that looks like on a graph, that was the prediction, and so we're quite pleased with what's happening, and the results are starting to kind of roll in, and so we don't want to lose that momentum. That's very important, and we're really committed. The board was very committed to keeping that up. So,
and it's worth understating that, or overstating that, underlining it, that is the most conservative methodology. We talk about this all the time in the council, how many other things that the state does where just merely talking to someone equates to well, that program gets credit for those jobs. It's the opposite of what happens in the Oregon Inc. world. So I'm constantly feeling like we're underselling that, yeah. But it is a real strength. So please be cognizant of that as you hear these numbers.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. It's always an interesting argument around other, when I look at my counterparts in other states, and we certainly have by far the most conservative reporting numbers for this type of work. But we have solid numbers, and we know what's happening. So that, you know, that's what the legislature wanted. So to that end, the core activities that we've asked the Signature Research Centers to pursue and put proposals together for in their scopes of work is, one, to continue to build the pipeline of companies that compete for that commercialization fund. That's a huge driver. Filling that gap between technology transfer at the universities and when a company becomes investable is a huge valley of death that they've been amazing at filling, and so we don't want that to stop. So they're going to continue that work. And two, to identify, design, and manage these potential high-impact opportunity projects. This is the sort of newest. There's not a lot of real fundamental changes to what we're proposing with Oregon Inc., but this is probably the one where these would have been industry initiatives in your minds before, where nonprofits would compete for this funding. Now we're going to public-private partnership models, where they're project-based, where we identify an opportunity, where there's universities, government, and industry involved, so that we can leverage that industry participation. They're wanting ways to plug in. Our universities, I think, are definitely at the table to do more applied research projects out in the field and solve industry problems. So those are the types of projects that we'd be looking for. And
I just want to say, I think one of the huge benefits of moving toward this high-impact opportunity strategy is that we can get in and out fast. So if a project has great potential, but quickly we see the partnerships aren't there or it's not going to come to fruition, through a project-based funding strategy, you can see the potential quickly, and that may take off and it may receive multiple rounds of funding. But if it's not going to work, you can pull out quickly. And in the past, when the state has been supporting organizations, that's been harder. So I think it actually gives the state and Oregon Inc. a better ability to move quickly, which I think is important.
And the council was really interested in this space, that space that the state could catalyze, where individual partners may not be incentivized or able to fill that space. Oregon Inc. is perfectly positioned, I think, to make those catalytic investments and bring those partners together. So this is the governor released her budget, and Oregon Inc. as a package was in it at 17.5. So that is the number that we are structuring this around. And the first section is really all about the high impact innovation. This is the normal package of Oregon Inc. that you might be accustomed to. The Signature Research Centers take up 7.5 of that, and that looks incredibly low, probably from the numbers that you are used to seeing. But that 7.5 represents those first two bullets and a little bit on operations and transition, because we do have things while we're building out these high impact opportunity projects, we have some things to figure out. So their numbers looked higher before because the commercialization fund, which is bullet number two, was embedded separately into ONAMI and Oregon Best's budget. So that's still available. They'll still be working with that. They just won't be managing the actual investment dollars. And the high impact opportunity public-private partnership projects will take up $4 million of the budget that we'll have as flexible investments when opportunities come along. And the SBIR line item there is a pilot project that we've done through the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund over the past year and a half at Business Oregon, and it's been wildly successful. We're actually 11th in the country for bringing home SBIR awards, which surprises most people, and I'll say that's despite any effort on our part to to really help with that. Our universities and our entrepreneurs have been great with that. That equates to almost $50 million of undilutive research grants from the federal government. And just in the year and a half, our pilot program has shown almost a 40-to-1 leverage on very small, less than $5,000 support to help some of these companies and researchers get grants. And it's been wildly successful. So we want to make that permanent, and we believe Oregon Inc. is the place for that to be permanent. So that equates to our 17.5, and happy to answer any questions.
Two quick ones that hopefully others will be useful to others. The SBIR, that is essentially the pursuit of those grants as opposed to matching those who have received them. Is that right?
We Chair Reed and members of the committee, we do both. We did pilot both. The big leverage comes for in helping navigate this federal grant terrain. They're very, very difficult to get. They're very competitive, very confusing. If you don't check one box that you need to check, they'll throw it away and not read it. So
that's what this is aimed at, is helping
that's
people.
That's what this is aimed at,
okay.
Getting them ready to apply for a phase one. Now, phase one SBIR can be up to $150,000 award, and they're grants. They don't come off your capital table. They're not equity investments from the federal government. They're grants. And phase two is up to $1.5 million. So if you apply for a phase one and qualify, you can actually apply and get a phase two, which is very significant money. So there are small amounts of match program in there as well, up to $50,000. It's not a lot, but you can use it for business development because there's a lot of restrictions on what the federal government will let you do with those.
And Representative Wisnett asked me, and I want to make sure my answer is right. How can you remind us how this total compares to the current biennium that we're about to finish?
So we were at 17.9 for the current biennium, and so we're at 17.5. I think if normal current service level would have happened, it would have been 18.6, which is what we had been planning on. But we were able to shave a few things off, and I think we still, with this package at this level, can and do what we need to do.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions? Representative McKeown, please.
You raised an issue. Thank you, Chair Reed. What did you shave off?
We cut down a little bit. We kept the signature research centers the same. We took most of that out of the public-private partnerships. The reason that we can't cut the commercialization fund is that we're trying to achieve what is accredited investor status on its own. So it's funny, SEC and securities, but the reason that the signature research centers were always taking charitable equity or making grants was because neither of them individually actually had met the $5 million mark to be considered an accredited fund. So we know that we need to keep that at five million so that it retains its accredited status and we can create much more systemic returns for the state with those dollars. So it came out of our flexible project funding, which hurt a little bit, but we're still, there's plenty in there to do a few really impactful projects.
Please.
So I'm back on your strategic bodies of work, innovation, capital, and ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So how does that impact those three silos?
Well, Representative McHugh and Chair Reed, thank you. It's been an interesting little over a year and a half, and looking for spaces for alignment and to get the capital working with the capital experts and the ecosystem and the 60 or so incubators and accelerators and small business development centers, economic development districts, and the many people who are doing business development services to look at how they have capacity to do that, similar to the REEF program. We're doing rural entrepreneurship. You know, how are we training entrepreneurs? And then what kind of capital is available for them when they are trained? And on the innovation side, what are we doing to encourage invention and the transfer of these technologies? So there's a lot of the reason those little arrows have Business Oregon logos on them is because I think we're aiming to be that connective tissue between those so that we're not doing a lot of overlap, that when we open up innovations and we do these high-impact opportunity projects, that we're also incentivizing through the Oregon Growth Board the right kind of capital for those industries, and then also the ecosystem knows how to train those entrepreneurs. So,
yes, please.
I guess what I'm looking at is as budgets are constrained and hard decisions have to be made, is there an eye towards that urban-rural equity as to how it impacts things that are going on across the state and not just in the metropolitan areas where this all began?
Yes, Representative McKeown and Chair Reed, thank you. That's absolutely what we're doing. Oregon Innovation Council is a huge tool. There are many incubators and accelerators that are not accessible to many parts of the state, many populations in the state. So that ecosystem bucket is really about connecting the state and all the communities in the state to the resources that the state has so generously and proactively invested in over the years so that they're being accessed by as many people as we can find. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for making that point. All right, I think we're done for the moment. But thank you for the preview and for the work. It is really a significant change and sort of refreshing of Oregon Inc. And I appreciate the work and hope to be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and for your continued support of Oregon Inc.
Thank you. So we'll move now back to the higher ed world, and we're happy to have an update from Portland State on the new academic advising model. I'm going to confess my nervousness at attempting your name, so I'm just going to say, please introduce yourself. I'm too afraid to get it wrong. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Chair Reed. My name is Sukhwan Jaj. I'm a faculty member at Portland State University, and I serve as Vice Provost for Academic Innovation and Student Success.
And my name is Linnell Spencer. I'm a career and academic advisor for the School of Business at Portland State University and also a member of the work group that has designed this new system.
Thank you.
It's a great honor to present our work to you. Before I begin, I want to thank you and your colleagues for the advocacy you do on a daily basis for our students. It's the investment in advising that came to us for hiring a number of new advisors that made much of this rethinking possible. Instead of doing more of what we were doing, we've actually spent a number of months rethinking the advising system, and we believe that what we are proposing here, the recommendations were accepted by the university for implementation, will fundamentally change advising and outcomes at Portland State University. I have the report that is being handed out, as well as one of the slides slightly blown up. The font is quite small in here. Our goal is to build the best student experience. We implement a portfolio of student success initiatives at Portland State University. We believe that the redesign of the academic programs, what happens in the classroom is important. At the same time, what happens in the redesign of services is vital. Our work is supported by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We have received over $1.5 million in grants over the past few years, and much of it is directed towards our academic innovation and student success work. Our work is quite unique. We involve students in problem posing and developing solutions. It's a very different approach used by us, and there are hardly any parallels in the country, the scale at which we are working. So in the initial planning grant that we received from Gates Foundation, we worked with our students to identify four unique ideas which they believe would make significant difference in their academic experience. The first one was this idea of coordinated service networks. Students tell us that they bounce around among services, and this is not unique to PSU, between advising and financial aid and bursar's office and other kinds of services, and they wanted us to solve that. We have, as a response to that, created a coordinated service network, which takes an analytics systems. It's a big data initiative that connects all students, all courses, all grades for the last 10 years to identify the risk a student faces when they're signing up for a course, so advising can take place before failure happens in the course. This system has now connected our financial aid office, our bursar's office, and our registrar's office. It went live in July, and we have had our first 100 students case managed through the system. The second project our students asked us to work on was interactive degree map. We're making progress on it. Here, students are telling us something very simple. They want to be able to plan their education. They want to know how much it is going to cost, and they want to understand what are the consequences of changes in their academic plan if they change a course. So what happens if scenarios? We issued an RFP, and we are looking forward to working with a software company in developing this tool. Our belief is that this problem should not be worked on by a single institution, so we are very much interested in working in partnership with others in our local ecosystem as well as nationally. The third one is redesign of MyPSU. How do students, particularly first-generation students, get equitable access to services offered by the university? So redesign of services and making services digital is at the heart of it. But more importantly, redesign of the advising system. Technology is vital, but it is the redesign of the people system that will make it all possible. Unless you can change the culture and the work, we cannot really draw on the potential of the contemporary technology that is being developed. Much of our work is guided by a very simple realization that in our higher education system, the education attainment is very clearly tied with income. Students in the top income quartile finish their college degree about 88% by the age 24. In the bottom income quartile, the number is 8%. The top income quartile has made 20% progress. The bottom income quartile, 2% progress in 20 years. So fundamental rethinking and service delivery as well as academic services is needed. Before we begin our work on advising redesign of our people system, our academic leadership set up a set of goals. They wanted one-on-one advising for students. That is, a student should have one person they can turn to in the university to solve their problem. It's a challenging problem because students change majors, and it's a good thing. Secondly, our employees are vital. Their success is vital, so work as a source of joy. How do you design work so that those who are engaged in it enjoy it? This is driven by business ideas around service value chain. Unified advising framework, how do you chain the variety of practices that happen across institution and come up with a single framework so that a community can be built and services improved, and increase students' self-efficacy and sense of agency, helping students do things on their own. We are never going to have adequate amount of resources to do service and create other kinds of networks. So whatever we can train our students to do on their own is vital so we can spend our time on high-value activities. I'm going to fly through this, and hopefully there'll be questions. Again, as I mentioned earlier, our work is driven by design thinking. I'm an architect by training. Harvard Business Review had a very good article, or actually a major publication on design thinking, what it is. But essentially what we do, we put students and employee at the center of our design effort, and we engage them in both problem posing as well as development of solutions. So we led a nine-month process where a small group of frontline employees led the work group. They engaged students in understanding what the problems they're facing. They engaged faculty members in it. We took solutions back to them, and the recommendations you will see in a minute, my colleague will share them with you, are driven by this kind of process. We conducted about 80 interviews of both faculty members and frontline employees who are engaging with students. We surveyed our students. Thousands of students were involved in a wide variety of processes. We paid students to join us in designing. We are getting paid for designing, so should they, and they work with us in developing ideas for it. A number of observations were made by students that are important for me to highlight. One, students wanted to engage with advisors early. The one-on-one relationship with advisors was very important to them. They valued also the relationship with faculty members. They wanted assistance around financial planning. It was very important for them that when they're having their advising conversation with advisors, that they get some assistance in that area. And they wanted to have career conversation on a consistent basis with their academic advisors. They wanted assistance with academic planning, the what-if scenario that I mentioned earlier. So those kinds of observation drove our work. When we looked at it, the practices varied quite widely across the institution, and part of our effort has been to distill down on a set of practices. With that, I'll bring you to this chart that we have shared with you. And Linnell will walk you through some of the key milestones that we have identified that all PSU students, whether they are freshmen or transfer, will go through. And then we have built our people system around how do you create those experiences for our students.
So the first thing that we heard from our students loud and clear, and a theme that sort of reiterated itself over and over, was that the current system that we have is confusing. It's difficult for them to navigate. Often they come into PSU and they don't know if they have an advisor, who their advisor is, how to find them, what kind of questions they can ask, or how to get connected. So we want to use this structure to create a front door for our students. And it's a place where they can get not only their pre-admission questions answered, but as they matriculate, be directly connected to one assigned advisor that they can go to throughout their time at PSU. And then this assigned advisor will also help them to navigate some of the other parts of the institution by explaining policies and procedures, but also helping make referrals to other offices as those questions arise for students. So through our work with students and faculty and other professional advisors, we really had to narrow down what were the most critical functions that students needed and expected from us along the way. And through that, we developed 5 milestones, which are touch points where advisors will engage with students around these critical functions at times when we really feel like they're needing them. So the first milestone is a first-year academic advising requirement where students will be required to meet with an advisor within their first term, 2 terms at PSU. We often don't get to see students until they're a year or more in, and at that point they've taken classes that they don't need or they've missed these critical course sequences, and it delays graduation, it can mess with their financial aid, but ultimately it's just a source of real frustration. So we want to connect them early, not only to help them have that point of contact for other areas, but just to help them avoid those curricular pitfalls. Our second milestone is a major verification process, which we're instituting. And really, advisors will guide students through this process of connecting with faculty, with career counselors, and with professionals in the field that they want to work in to make sure that not only do they understand their major, but their major is a good fit for their skills and interests, and that it really does match up to their long-term goals. It's really difficult for us when we work with students and we see them struggling through classes in a major that they don't actually need to get where they want to go. So this will help our students be confident that they're in the right place and kind of give them some information for their long-term goals as well. Our third milestone is a career conversation, mandatory career advising for our students. And our students told us loud and clear that this is something they need from us. They want that support around what happens next. That's equally as important to them as their academic and their course planning questions. And they don't feel well served by a system that doesn't talk to them about that. So by having this conversation early, we can help students make a plan to develop those job readiness skills and to understand how to look for jobs and internships, to do exploration around their major and those types of things. Our next milestone is a financial planning conversation where we can provide some more tools and literacy for our students. We know that financial concerns create huge barriers to completion for our students, and that even the basic understanding of financial aid and financial planning can make huge difference in their success. Some of the work that we're doing at PSU, just preliminary research, shows that just taking one personal finance class is giving our students higher overall retention and completion rates than students who don't do that. So we know that this is important work, and advisor will take this opportunity to start that conversation with students and to be working really closely with student financial services and financial aid to make sure that they have the tools that they need to be planning their academics and their finance stuff at the same time. And then our final milestone is a graduation planning and application session with their advisor. I have on occasion worked with students who leave PSU and 5 or 10 years down the road, while they're applying to a graduate school or changing careers, they find that they were never granted the guarantee that they or the degree that they thought that they had, simply because they missed this step of applying for their degree. Or we work with students who have applied for their degree, but they have missed this critical requirement in their last couple of terms. So this can be, I mean, this is a time loss, this is a monetary loss, sometimes it's a job loss for our students who think they have a degree that they don't have. So by creating this sort of last step planning, we can ensure that towards the end of their program, they understand what all their requirements are, and they understand how to apply for their degree and make sure that they're ready for that next step. And really, again, I just want to sort of express my gratitude to you on behalf of our community. Just 5 touch points can make a huge difference for students, but without the support for this work and adding these new advisors, it would be extremely difficult to guarantee that we can see one student 5 times in their time at PSU. So this really, I think, will move the needle for student outcomes as really an important part of our work. So I thank you.
I'm really impressed with the way you put this together. It's very understandable to at least me, and I appreciate the sort of comprehensive approach you've taken to it. I imagine there are questions. I have some if others don't. But Representative Gallegos, please.
Yeah, one question, Dr. Hodge, particularly since you're a faculty. I mean, I can appreciate the trajectory is student-focused, and we want to graduate students. What does this mean for faculty? I'm really curious. I mean, our institutions of education, you know, our major workforce centers. I mean, we employ a lot of people. We create jobs through our universities. So I think, you know, that's another element in this whole discussion. What does this mean in terms of faculty time? What does it mean in terms of tenure? I mean, are we still going to consider advising as part of that role for faculty? What's your thoughts?
You know, this is a great question. So we tried to understand faculty attitudes towards advising. We surveyed all faculty members at PSU and those that have important roles in it. We interviewed them one-on-one for an hour-long interview and shared the results with the community. Our attitudes vary greatly based on the academic culture of the college. For example, in business school, faculty very much have a mentoring role. In engineering, they have a very much a hands-on approach. In other colleges, it's a mix based on department. So what we have proposed is a different model. We believe that faculty engagement with advising is vital, but it is to happen at junior level and higher and focused on mentoring. So what courses to take for graduate school? How do you take a particular set of courses for a specialization? Or in general, broad mentoring activities. Faculty would have a very important role around advising, and those who have an interest in being, I haven't gone into the roles category here because we have also redefined the roles, of being an assigned advisor. They can be an assigned advisor, but then they must engage in these 5 milestones, as well as we have identified 14 critical activities that every advisor must do. So I think we've tried to strike the right balance between mentoring and the assigned advisor role for that purpose. And our faculty have supported us in this effort as such because it offers them the flexibility based on the academic culture to engage with it. Thank you.
So you asked, Representative Gallegos kind of asked my question. You kind of answered it, but I want to be a little more direct about it. Any kind of, my experience has been any kind of big change like this or proposal is often met with a little bit of resistance and sort of the defense of the status quo. What's been your experience in that respect?
Our process, Chair Reid, our process has been somewhat different. As I said, we have used a design thinking process. Mm-hmm. We have been incredibly transparent with our change effort. And we have worked with a design consultancy named Explain, based in Portland, for just organizing our change effort. So we have brought people along over the last 8 months to this particular point. I believe in an academic setting, disengagement is essential for improving the quality of our solution. So we will, in general, disagree. And we have changed our recommendation based on the feedback that we have received. But our faculty and our advisors, as well as our students, all told us that high degree of clarity is needed. There were some areas where there were blind spot, no action was taken. Other areas, duplication was taking place. So we expect that by clarifying what we have to do, we would be able to move this work forward. But I expect that there will be disagreement as we move forward. And I think it's an important part of being in the academic setting.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, please.
Chair Reid, thank you. As I look at the sequencing and the providing of services, you know, historically one of the things that I think we learn in college is moving out of our home to a college and to a job. And when you get to that job, you need to be self-sufficient and be able to get to work and provide the service in whatever area that job is. Where in your curriculum here or your advising process here do you kind of teach, okay, now you got to stand alone, right? If we kind of wrap services around students all the way through college, and then we say, here's your degree, here's your job, where do they get that independence part?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, if I may, I'll let my colleague, who's the academic advisor, answer that question, and then I'll follow up with some comments.
Sure. Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, I think these touch points are designed as students move along to be more hands-off increasingly. And even, I mean, we're at PSU, but I think this is the culture of universities overall. We have students that are at varying degrees of needing that from us. And so that first mandatory advising appointment is often an assessment of exactly what they need. And then as you move on, it's increasingly more giving them the tools, explaining to them how things are, and often it's a use of technology, understanding a job search, understanding an interview process, those kinds of things, and then giving them those tools to kind of go out on their own. And we do see when we're able to do this with students that they increasingly come back to us with new ideas and things that we didn't even know to tell them. So I think it is a progression towards the end, where ideally that graduation appointment at the end is really just a 5-minute quick, you've done all the things that you need to do, as opposed to having to hold their hand and walk them through that kind of experience.
If I may add to that, one of our goals is to increase students' self-efficacy, their ability to do things on their own. So outside the advising process, if you will look at redesign of my PSU as well as our degree map work, we want the tools to exist that make it very easy for students to do this work on their own. So their interactions with their advisors or with their faculty members is spent on higher order questions. So it's not just basic planning activities that are there. But it's a very important question that you're asking.
Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your work. This is really, really good work. But I was just talking to Representative Gallegos, and it's really mind-boggling to me that this represents cutting-edge changes at our universities. And I think if this is, in fact, represents something that hasn't been done and hasn't been ongoing in terms of student support services, it's no wonder why our 4-year graduation rates are where they're at in this state. So I would hope that as we work within the Council of Universities, and I see Dana back there smiling, this needs to be best practice and be shared across the board. I mean, I'd be willing to entertain a draft legislation, I'm sure I can get Representative Wisnett to sign on with me, that before universities come asking for their capital construction request this next biennium, that they show us evidence that they have this type of student support service in place so we can ensure that we're graduating our students on time, or at least giving them a fair shot too. So I thank you for what you're doing, but I really hope there's a way to make sure that this becomes standard practice at all of our universities. Now, this is a reason why, with the Oregon Promise presentation we had earlier, that some of us really dove in last session and said it's not just about getting these folks to enroll, it's about getting them to completion and making sure we had some resources available in this biennium to help those Oregon Promise students succeed. So hats off for what you're doing. It's great work. I'm sure we'll see some outcomes shortly from PSU and improved, not just retention, but completion. But this needs to be status quo across the board in Oregon. So thanks for my rant, Mr. Chair.
When you hear a legislator saying everyone should have to do what you do, that's a pretty strong endorsement. So good for you. We appreciate it. Any other comments? Well, I hope you will be back to these fine people who will continue on in the legislature, and I'm confident they will want to help spread your lessons to other universities. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that takes us to our next presentation on Latino workforce development with Alberto Moreno and Cord Bucher, please. Thanks for the help.
That one I know.
That's great. Still doing okay on our timing, so we appreciate your being concise as well.
I'd like to see in the system, they talk about using students who they paid to come up with a report. I'd like to use students.
Spot me so you can get to the maps.
That's pretty good. but youth, peer pressure, peers are more important than anything.
Right.
and it helps them develop students too.
In the future.
I wouldn't have graduated college without my peers and the fraternity forces.
That's good. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, Vice Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. My name is Court Bucher. I'm the Workforce Policy Analyst with Youth Development Council.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Alberto Moreno. I'm Chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs and also the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. And I believe I have the distinct pleasure of starting us off on this part of the agenda.
Very good.
I wanted to first extend my apologies to you. I do not have pretty pictures or graphs that are embedded into my presentation. It is beyond my skill set. If we'd had some of my younger staff here presenting, they would have done it without blinking. But you have me to contend with, so my apologies in advance.
No problem.
And I'm here to talk about the Latino workforce in Oregon. There are, as you know, 496,000 Latinos in the state who are a highly productive workforce. Often working two or more jobs is not uncommon for us. Specifically, there are over 200,000 Latinos in the workforce in Oregon, representing about 10.5% of the total workforce in the state. Additionally, there are 160,000 farm workers who contribute over $5.3 billion annually to the state's economy. Oh, yes. I'm supposed to be clicking as we do this. Thank you. The Latino workforce makes significant contributions to the state, and this is what where we are represented. The highest percentage are employed in service occupations at 28%, followed by natural resources, construction, and maintenance at 20%, production, transportation, and material moving at 18%, sales and office occupations at about 17.7%, and management, business science, and the arts at 15.7%. Am I going backwards? Thank you. It is worth noting that the purchasing power of this workforce in Oregon is about $7 billion. These are 2009 figures, so they've gone up a little bit since then. But that represented a 660% increase from 1990. Worth noting that in just the Salem metro area, the purchasing power of Latinos is close to $1 billion, $955 million to be precise, and that's just in the Salem area. Latino business owners are helping to drive economic recovery in Oregon. We saw a 78% increase in the number of Latino-owned businesses from 2002 to 2007, and there were, at that time, 11,338 Latino-owned businesses in Oregon, up significantly from 6,360 in 2002. And it's worth noting that Oregon was among the 10 states with the highest Latino business growth rate, with a rate nearly double that of the national trend. It is important to say that the rate of growth for the Latino-owned businesses was over four times as much as total business growth in the state. And so that gives us a benchmark when we compare it to other populations. The receipts for these small businesses in Oregon that are Latino-owned had a record of $1.663 billion in receipts. That is $1.663 million in receipts in 2007, which represented a 7.5% increase from 2002. Mm-hmm. this next slide talks not just about Latino, but also Latin immigrant workers who represent a significant percentage of workers in these occupations. So the numbers here are a little bit higher than what you saw me reference, because now we're also including Latin immigrants in the figures. So 58.8% of the workforce in farming, fishing, and forestry occupations, 28% in building and grounds cleaning and maintenance, 23.5% in material moving, 20% in food preparation and serving, and 16.6% in construction and extraction. Latino immigrant workers help to bridge the gap between our aging workforce and a much younger, smaller population of young native-born workers. That is to say, as a general population, we tend to be younger, with a median age of 34 compared to 38 for the dominant community. We contribute significantly to GDP funds through income and taxes. The Oregon Center for Public Policy estimates that undocumented immigrants in Oregon earned between $2.3 billion and $4.5 billion in 2011 and made contributions between $154 million to $309 million in the state and federal taxes. Oregon employers paid an additional $121 million to $243 million in state and federal taxes on behalf of those workers. This is where we begin, I think, to see some significant disparities. The average salary for Latino versus their white counterparts, Latinos make an average of $19,500 annually, in comparison to non-Hispanic whites who make about $30,000. And so you can see a significant salary gap. This has implications. It means, for example, that they do not enjoy the same access to economic opportunity, do not enjoy the same level of workplace-sponsored health insurance. In fact, 21% of us are uninsured compared to 8% of whites. We are also unable to extend those same benefits to their spouses and to their children in instances for the same reasons. We're also more likely to have to pull limited resources, including higher percentage in shared housing situations. We tend to live in unsafe neighborhoods with higher crime rates. We live in places and regions with food deserts and more limited access to resources. The implications are that low-skilled jobs for our children means that the cycle of poverty is preserved in our communities, meaning that our families are not adequately represented in some key opportunity professions, which in turn results in fewer teachers who look like us, fewer teachers who have the same shared lived experience, who do not speak our languages, fewer health professionals who also do not look like us, who are not bilingual, bicultural, who do not understand, as a matter of practice, the barriers we face to accessing health care. And this disparity is especially pronounced when we talk about mental health and oral health. As I travel the state, these are the two major unaddressed issues in our community, lack of access to oral health, and then a pronounced lack of access to culturally and linguistically responsive mental health providers. There are very few in the state, I'm afraid. We also have fewer attorneys who can speak for us, stand for us. The police force doesn't always reflect our demographics or our language, which in some instances means that we have increased negative adjudication for the same offenses, and oftentimes greater representation in the juvenile and adult correctional systems. With unequal pay, we have unequal access to economic and educational opportunities. Our children are less likely to afford going to college, which in turn locks them into the same cycle of poverty with the same limited employment opportunities faced by their parents. This doesn't have to be so. Oregon can reverse this trend by making investments in education and workforce training. Thank you so much for your attention this morning.
Thank you.
Do you want to switch out to...
We'll see if we can figure out how to do that. We may need Ashley, is it? Thank you.
Here, actually, you can pass the mouse over, and I think I can, if it'll reach.
Yeah. Or I can switch.
Yeah, we'll swap. It's fine.
So as you're switching, I was just flipping through the slides. It looks like you guys have a lot of the same material in terms of demographics and that sort of stuff, so we'll appreciate your covering that quickly.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair Reed.
Good morning.
Vice Chair Gallegos, Vice Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. My name, again, is Cord Bucher. I'm the Workforce Policy Analyst for the Youth Development Council. I'm going to be focused primarily on youth and youth, Latino youth access to the workforce in my notes and remarks today. So I'll just start with a brief recap of the Youth Development Council's mission. We are tasked with supporting the education system by developing state policy and administering funding to support community-based and school-based youth development programs, services, and initiatives for youth ages 6 to 24. The council advocates for youth in Oregon, including changes in state law policy and state funding for programs and services that support youth education, career workforce development, and juvenile crime prevention, with a focus on positive youth development. My area of focus in looking at workforce issues for youth is on the older end of our age range spectrum, so my remarks are going to really focus on 16 to 24-year-olds and their access, success in education and access to the workforce. So I'm going to begin with some demographic data. So the estimate that I have for the Latino population in Oregon, 473,000, and that was, I believe, from ACS data over 2011 to 2014. So it is an estimate, but that brings it to about 12% of the state's total population. And that's 72% growth since the year 2000. Native-born Latinos account for 65% of the growth in the state of Oregon. But it's an exceptionally fast-growing population within the state. The median age of Latinos in Oregon is 24 years old, so it's also a very young population. And the estimated Latino population in Oregon in 2015 was about 86,000. So we're talking about a large group of young people here in the state. In terms of school enrollment, 21% of Oregon high school seniors the last school year were Hispanic or Latino. From 2008 to 2028, the expected percentage of graduates is expected to grow from 12 to 33%. In 2014-15, Latino students represented 22% of the enrolled K through 12 students. But as Mr. Moreno pointed out, they're not reflected in the teaching staff, and only 3.9% of all teachers were Latino. So I'll move to some educational outcomes. In terms of graduation rates, here we've got a comparison of the graduation rate in four-year and five-year cohorts for Latino youth compared to all youth in the state of Oregon. So here for this would have been in the year 2015, 72% graduation rate for all youth compared to a 64.9% graduation rate for Latino youth. In the following year, so the five-year cohort, this would be youth who graduated within 5 years, the rate for all youth goes up to 76.5%, and the rate for Latino youth is at 71.4%. So the gap does close slightly, but it is still behind the overall rate. There is an exception I wanted to point out. So a recent ODE report on CTE programs highlighted the fact that for many populations, graduation rates from CTE programs were far better than that of the general graduation rate. So here, the CTE graduation rate for all students was 87.5%. In that report, they point out that for Latino students, it's just slightly behind the overall rate at 85.9%. And then you compare that to the four-year graduation rate for Latino students, it's a big difference. So there's definitely some promising outcomes happening in CTE programs in terms of the impact on graduation, particularly for students of color in the state. The dropout rate here, I'll just quickly note, It has arisen for all groups in the past few years, and the dropout rate overall is 4.26% in 2015. The dropout rate for Latino youth was 5.27%. It's just about 1% more, but that is a substantial number of young people who left school during that year. So I'm going to move on to some college enrollment data. It was recently noted that the overall enrollment in Oregon public universities of Latino students has increased dramatically. It was 4.3% in 2007, up to 9.8% in 2016. And of the 102,000 students enrolled in these universities, almost 10,000 are Hispanic Latino. Here I've got some graduation rate information on colleges. Now, this data here is strictly for first-time and full-time college students, so this should somewhat represent, you know, a younger college population. This excludes returning students and part-time students. So here you see the graduation rate in 4 years and 6 years from four-year universities in Oregon compared to the U.S. rate. And it is slightly behind. And then if you look at the rate for Latino students, it is about 7% behind in Oregon, the overall rate. And it makes up a little bit of ground in the six-year rate, but it is also behind the rate for all students. And then looking again at community colleges, you can see that the Oregon rates are behind the U.S. rate, and for Latino students, it is behind the overall state rate. This, again, is just for full-time and first-time students at two-year universities in Oregon, two-year colleges, excuse me, in Oregon. And I did look for some data on longer-term completion, and the rate does go up, but Latino students continue to be behind the overall rate of completion at two-year universities in the state. And I'm going to touch on some employment data. Here we've got some youth employment data. So the overall unemployment rates you could see there at the top. And looking at all youth, 16 and 19-year-olds, have a much higher unemployment rate than the population as a whole. And you look at 20 to 24-year-olds, that also is a higher rate than the overall unemployment rate. The unemployment rate does drop when you get to this older group. And in Oregon, it actually was lower in those estimates for 20 to 24-year-olds than the national rate. And looking at Hispanic or Latino youth, in the United States, as you can see, there is a higher rate of unemployment for both age groups. So one of the things that I'll point out in my recommendations is that data is very hard to find, particularly when it comes to disaggregated demographic level data on employment. And so the estimates there for the Oregon unemployment rates for Hispanic or Latino youth are from the American Community Survey. So I want to just give the caveat that these are rough estimates, and for the teenage group, there's a wide range of error. But for 20 to 24-year-olds, we're pretty confident that it's within 5 to 9%. But as you can see, so for teenage Latino youth, it's a much higher rate of unemployment than it is for Oregonian youth as a whole. But that rate drops a lot when you get to 20 to 24-year-olds, which is promising. It's showing that there is a lot of employment happening. And then opportunity youth, I want to touch on this as well because this is the area of focus in my work. Opportunity youth are defined as young people 16 to 24 who are disconnected from both education and the workforce. It includes unemployed youth as well as those who are not looking for work. So I think the distinction needs to be made that an unemployed young person is counted as a participant in the labor force. They're looking for a job and can't find one. Opportunity youth includes those youth as well as those who are not currently looking for work or reengaging in education. And so this is a percentage of 16 to 24-year-olds who are not in school or working. And this is calculated using the American Community Survey data, which is census data. So these are estimated rates for 2011 to 2014 for Oregon. And so, again, these are estimates based on ACS data, which leads to some possibility of the variance, but these are averaged over a four-year period to try to get us close to something accurate. So if we look at the overall rate, it's about 14.5% for that period. And if you look at the rate for Hispanic and Latino youth, it is higher than the overall rate, not among the highest rates, but still above average, higher than that of white and Asian youth in the state. If you look at the national rates versus the state rates, in the year 2013, in that particular year, there was a lower opportunity youth rate for Latino students, but it was still about equal to the overall rate nationally. And nationally, Latino youth are more likely to be opportunity youth. And if I don't know if I can jump back, but the averaged rate for the state for Latino youth was slightly lower than the national opportunity youth rate. So I'll make a couple of recommendations around how to support Latino youth in their transition from education to the workforce. Of course, cultural literacy and competency within educational institutions and training is valuable and important. Family support and translation services. A lot of the reading that I did really points out the success in school districts that have strengthened their family outreach and services and supports for families. Targeted dropout prevention and re-engagement efforts, pulling those that have dropped out of school back in and providing opportunities for them to complete their education is valuable. CTE programs and opportunities for work-based learning, and post-secondary exposure access and support, along with increased data collection, could help to reverse some of these trends. And the data collection piece, again, is really valuable because when we try to look at how many youth are disconnected in the state, the data is far less complete in rural communities, and many rural communities in Oregon have the highest percentages of Latino populations, so that would be very helpful in looking at this. And then some recommendations specifically for workforce development, educational support and skill development, including academics, life skills, financial literacy, career exploration, work experience, mentoring, using positive youth development principles, and providing wraparound support along with cultural literacy and competency are valuable. And I'm going to complete just by noting some YDC programs doing work around workforce development for youth. We have some grants we gave out this year, 2016 Entrepreneurship and Career Readiness Projects. As of the first quarter, they had served 218 youth located throughout the state, and the focus of these programs is providing training in entrepreneurship and career readiness and work experience. So these participants include high school students, graduates, and opportunity youth. And of the 218 youth, 68 or 31% identified as Latino Hispanic. And the program models include everything from school-based college exploration and access, social enterprise entrepreneurship activities, and connections to career coaching through a boxing program, which actually has been a really interesting project to see unfold, and it's been very successful. And part of that, I think, has to do with the cultural competency of the person leading that project. Activities of these programs include college and career exploration, work readiness training, and the aforementioned entrepreneurship activities, as well as mentoring and job placement. And some of the key culturally specific services include that mentoring piece, as well as at a project in Madras, we have two community organizations, Juntos and Avanza, that have been providing family supports and student supports for Latino students that have been very helpful. And I'll go ahead and conclude there and answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
That was impressive that you got through 20 slides that quickly.
And we're quick. Only at 5 minutes. So.
I appreciate it. Well done. Thank you. Representative McKeown, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I'm curious, in Madras, are those two organizations local? Are they replicatable in some regard? Can you tell me a little bit more about them?
Sure. Chair Reed and Representative McKeown, the Juntos program is based at OSU, and they actually, I believe, do services in a number of communities in Oregon. I'm less familiar with Avanza. I think that is a local program, mm-hmm. But Juntos is a statewide program, and actually they helped me with some of my research, so I'm looking forward to learning more about their work, but they are focused on OSU but provide services around the state.
I'm just curious. They're schools with similar demographics as Madras, and I'm just curious as to how you can take a good thing and spread the wealth around a little bit. It'd be interesting to know a little bit more about that.
Chair Reed and Representative McKeown, yes, I'm actually excited to see this. This wasn't a part of their original project. These organizations came on board as they developed their partnerships to deliver the services, and I've heard really good things about that, so I'm just learning about this work as we observe these grants, and I hope to have more knowledge of their work and impact in that school.
A follow-up for us would be great.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos, please.
Just a brief comment. I thank you both for the presentation. One of the interests I had in this presentation was the fact that the Latino community being the fastest growing ethnic community in the state, and we could look at other groups as well, but what I'm really interested in, it's really a math problem. And as has been pointed out, the growth of this population and yet the school success that leads into the workforce issues, I think, is, as I said, clearly a math issue that we need to look at if we want to reach 40-40-20 in general in the state. And it just seems to me, I mean, you guys mentioned the issue of the age, median age, for example. 24 years old for the Latino community versus 40 years old for the white community. I mean, that's a significant difference. And the significance really has to do with having babies, right? The other fact that is important is the Latino women tend to have more babies than the general population, and they tend to have babies later in life, more so than other groups. So it's just an incredibly important demographic that we need to, the legislature needs to attend to and make sure that we're acknowledging the tremendous growth in this population. At this point, we're going to have like one out of every four kids in K-12 being Latino. And again, if we don't look at that graduation rate and make sure that we're attending to that, our workforce is really not going to be the efficient and meet the needs of the state. I really do think we're heading in the right direction, but I would say that to continue that kind of direction, we need to require a healthy community, starting with prenatal care, cover all children, making sure that school success is really part of that whole healthy community as well. So thank you again for your presentation.
Yeah, very helpful. Just
thank
looking
you.
To make sure if there are any other comments. Thank you for getting us started on that. We're going to move to another cultural competency discussion, so you've set the stage very well. And that brings us to Cheryl Myers, Brent Finkbeiner, and Mariana Sofia Paradones, please.
Said that, kid.
Is that all right?
I'm sorry. Good to me.
Thank you.
Very nice. Very nice.
Good morning, Chair Reed and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cheryl Myers, Chief Culture, Diversity, and Inclusion Officer for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, lovingly known as the HEC. Wonderful. So in 2015, House Bill 3308 charged the HEC to convene a work group to address disparities in higher education, primarily through continuing education. And it included looking at students of color, students with disabilities, LGBTQ students, first-generation students, veteran students, and English language learner students. So it was fairly broad. We convened a work group that was very diverse and included very strong student voice and focus. We had 10 formal members of the work group, 6 additional stakeholders, and 5 HEC staff that supported the work of the large work group. The recommendations, the background being during session, student testimony identified numerous troubling experiences in the classroom, and these are some of them. Also noting, as you've been hearing all morning, that several Oregon post-secondary institutions contain between 35% and 40% minority student populations, and that number is only going to grow. The key recommendations from the report, which was submitted last spring and distributed to all legislators, is located on our website. But these are some of the key recommendations of the work group. There were really three subcommittees were formed in regard to the process. A standards committee that looked at the Oregon Health Authority model for continuing education for health workers and established 3 tiers of competency, an existing training and research subcommittee that looked at both national and Oregon best practices and did a literature review, and an implementation and challenges, implementation challenges and opportunity in a proactive manner to really see, you know, how we might, things that we might encounter, including looking at surveying the institutions at large. As I said, there's a full report that all of you should have, and we were very happy to work with this wonderful group of people that brought forward these recommendations. And I'm going to turn it over. I think, Brent, are you going next?
I'll go next.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Like to go next?
Mr. President.
All right, Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. My name is Brent Finkbeiner, and I truly appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak in front of you. I'm currently a student at Portland State University, where I'm the chair of the Student Senate, and working towards my bachelor's in business management and leadership. last year as student body president at Clackamas Community College and board chair for the Oregon Community College Student Association, I had the opportunity to participate in HB 3308 work group. And I want to tell you why it's so important to me and the impact that it can have on our communities. And I was going to torture you with about a 10-minute speech, but I cut it in half. I had to cut it down a little bit, sure. Cultural competency is an important part of everyday American life. Unfortunately, it does not get the attention that it deserves. We do not have enough open dialogue on what it means to be culturally competent. It means understanding that culture, including ethnicity, color, creed, ability, and need, all shape very much who we are. And it means making an attempt to understand the nuances of what happens where cultures intersect and how the impact is global. Within our nation, it means understanding that different individuals have wildly different experiences here in America. No two are exactly the same. There's a myth being propagated today that we shouldn't see color or gender, that we shouldn't look at these things. And that idea, it sounds great, it sounds moral, and it sounds just. But only if we think ahistorical, only if we pretend that yesterday has no impact on today. And I don't think rational people assume that. I think that the truth is being colorblind or something of the like is a very privileged stance to take. For generations, people of color, women, people with disabilities in this nation have had no choice but to look at their own color, gender, ability, and be defined by it according to the dominant population. Before I continue, I'd like to add some context. I am a veteran of the Army. I served as a combat medic from 2006 to 2010. I saw one deployment to Iraq with the 4th Infantry Division, and I love my country, including everyone in it, very, very much. I fought for the idea that we are the land of the free and the home of the brave, the idea that in this land all men are created equal. I thought that the documents that I swore my life to were pure and that they were just. However, I learned with just a little bit of education that those statements apply to only able-bodied white men and certainly not people of color, certainly not women, and certainly not people with disabilities. It pains me greatly to know that I fought for the land of the free, only to find out that there are people alive today that remember a time in this nation when they did not have simple, basic, and equal human rights. It pains me even more to hear the rhetoric that's equivalent to, well, they should just get over it because it's better now, that those laws have gone away with. And I don't think that's acceptable, and I don't think it's even accurate because there are still some very real problems today. Many communities face disparities in higher education, and they face them today, and it's not a problem of yesterday. It happens right now. Communities are students of color, students in the LGBTQ community, students with disabilities, non-traditional students, first-generation students, immigrant students, and international students, among others. Each of these communities faces a unique set of challenges that are often ignored and misunderstood. Cultural competency means giving these communities the attention and understanding they deserve. Cultural competency for the educators is about understanding who is in the classroom. And a certain demographic that gets much praise but not much understanding are veterans. Students who have served in the armed forces already face a challenge of transitioning back into a civilian life. And educators who are unaware of what that transition means can inadvertently make things a whole lot worse. Since 2001, we've seen a dramatic increase in veteran suicide rates. In 2014, 7,403 veterans took their lives. It's one of the saddest things to consider that someone who once served their nation no longer wants to live in that nation, or even at all. I can personally attest to the importance of higher education in adjusting to a normal life. I wouldn't have made it this far. I would not be sitting in front of you without the love and support that I've received from the professionals at Clackamas Community College. Trust me when I tell you that trained professionals fluent in veterans affairs can help restore purpose and restore the lives of our great servicemen and women. The positive impact that LC 2430 could have on colleges and universities is exponential. For too long, we've gone without a measure for cultural competence in education, and this bill could fix that. It could give each institution the means to establish oversight into the matter and handle issues as they see fit, meaning institutions can tailor their programs to the specific needs of the communities. This bill would give us the opportunity to establish the much-needed dialogue surrounding our the culture in our nation right down to the individual. The oversight committees would be comprised of necessary stakeholders in an effort to find out what areas need attention per each institution. By addressing the importance of cultural competence in higher education, we are laying the foundation for acceptance, creating an environment where everyone feels safe, respected, and included. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You mentioned LC 2430. That's not one that I'm familiar with. Is that whose concept is that?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. It was the number that I was given for the draft for this bill.
Ah, so it's what led to 3308. Is that right?
I believe 3308 has led into 2430.
Yeah. So it's one that's coming. So I'm back to the original question. Is there an individual legislator who's proposing that, or is it going to be a committee? What else do we know about that one? It's not one I'm familiar with.
Sure. What else do we know?
I would defer to Lamar.
Yeah, Lamar.
Okay.
So.
We'll postpone that question then, I guess, for the moment. Okay. Sorry to distract. Ms. Pardonis, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnant, Representative Gallegos, and members of the legislature. For the record,
and just move that a little bit farther away from you, then it will not distort as much.
Thanks. That's fine. So my name is Mariana Sofia Paredones, and I'm a student at Lane Community College. I'm a member of the Oregon Student Association, and I was recently appointed to be the student commissioner on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So I'm here to talk to you all about the House Bill 3308 Workgroup and why it's important to all students and members of our communities that we have cultural competency in our institutions. I strongly believe that this is the right direction towards addressing these quintessential issues on college campuses, and this does include safety and a strive for true equity and how that impacts our ability to be successful and, to be honest, to survive as well. Cultural competency would give students, faculty, staff, and administrators a much-needed responsibility to work together and push for addressing the disparities many traditionally marginalized communities face on a daily basis, such as racism, homophobia, transphobia, sexism, classism, and ableism. Many of which I have faced and seen many students and faculty experience as well. The unique addition within the legislative concept 2430 is that it would allow students and faculty on our campuses to come together and meet and, you know, open this dialogue. Because honestly, individual reportings of incidents, it's just not really addressing the issue at hand, and you know how to correctly address these issues is important. And I feel like through these committees on our campuses, it would start those conversations because each campus is unique. Each campus, you know, between rural, between, you know, like my campus, that's a more commuter campus, has, you know, non-traditional students. We have different needs, we have different experiences, and there's different ways to assess that. So through this work within the legislative concept 2430, it would allow for that dialogue and for that openness. I've been attending Lane Community College for 2 years now as a full-time student, and I can still recall my first term and the eagerness I felt to start my post-secondary education. I assumed, you know, I'm from Arizona. I assumed, you know, coming to a college in Oregon that it was going to be, you know, more inclusive, more progressive. And however, I quickly began to realize this wasn't the case too quickly. I face microaggressions and, you know, just these oppressive moments every day in and out of school. In an introductory writing class I took my first term, I had a peer make several remarks about my identity. They called me a border jumper, a spick, a beaner. And one day during class, my instructor at the time actually asked me if I knew where the best Mexican restaurant in Eugene was. I felt humiliated. I felt discouraged from wanting to go to that class, but it is a required course, and, you know, we all have to take that to graduate. And it's sad because I felt that in order to protect myself, I had to isolate my identity and culture, and at times I despised myself and who I was, and I couldn't wait for the last day of that class. And even in conversations I had with this peer and my instructor, I'm like, you know, like, I don't really feel comfortable when you talk about me this way. It just never really got addressed. And I do think that that was because, you know, we're not taught how to communicate with each other. We're not taught how to interact with each other and how to meet each other's needs. And that does come from a place of compassion. That does come from a place of wanting our education to be truly holistic, you know. The second term I took at Lane, it didn't get much better. I've seen instructors purposely misgender trans students within our classrooms, even when trans students will, you know, directly say, hey, I actually use these pronouns, or this is the name I go by. And seeing, you know, students fickle out of classes towards the end of the term, they stop coming to class. I know I stopped coming to one of my classes for a little bit because I just didn't feel comfortable with the way my instructor was calling Native Americans Redskins on presentations. While there are policies against discrimination on our campuses, there's not an effective mechanism for how to address discrimination to begin with. Cultural competency does this. Through the work of the House Bill 3308 that I was also part of with these two amazing individuals, and thank you, Representative Gallegos, for really putting a lot of effort and work into that, and members of the HEC, we did a lot of work. We did a lot of research. We outreached to campuses to see, you know, what are some of the policies on your campus that, you know, are in relation to cultural sensitivity trainings, cultural fluency trainings. What does that look like on your campuses? And through a lot of that research and through a lot of, you know, identifying how to implement cultural competency, we realized, you know, there are different campuses have different needs, and in order for those needs to be met, it needs to come from the campus within itself. So that's really where these recommendations tie in with this legislative concept, is by starting those dialogues. And, you know, like Representative Gallegos mentioned, it's easier to talk a lot about, you know, the issues at hand, but there's not enough action. How do we move forward? It's hard to say what that looks like exactly right now, but it's also something we can't ignore. You know, throughout this past year, I have seen the climate on our campuses just skyrocket with tension. There have been, you know, multiple reports throughout this past year that have just increased in racial tension, in transphobic tension, and this can't be ignored. We're seeing students across our state doing direct actions, walking out, calling out, you know, racism on their campuses. And it's right now it's an opportunity for our state, for our government, to really address these issues. And in order to do this, we need to start those dialogues and we need to implement legislative concept 2430. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and thanks for your willingness to serve on the HEC. Some of us were here when the creation of the HEC took place, and so it's good to see new folks taking part in that. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any comments or questions? We appreciate it. Representative Gagas, do you want to give any sort of should we bring
sure,
Lamar up?
Sure, well, yeah, we can bring Lamar up, and, okay. And thank you all for
thank you.
Yes,
thank you,
thank you very much.
Yeah.
Lamar, why don't you join us, please?
Yeah, this particular LC is a outgrowth of the report we just heard, 3308 that was passed, and that task force makes this recommendation for which this bill comes.
Very good.
Lamar, you want
to? Why don't you tell us, since a number of people have referred to it, give us a preview and an outline of the LC, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the record, my name is Lamar Wise, and I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. So the recommendations that the HEC came up with essentially is legislative concept 2430, with the exception of with the exception of creating cultural competency oversight committees for each campus so that they can do their own personalized standards and trainings that fit their campus the best. Cheryl Myers went over in terms of the recommendations, that's essentially what the concept is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's its status? Is there a particular legislator that's going to introduce it, or are you seeking it to be a committee bill?
We do have legislators lined up. So, for example, Representative Elect Hernandez has taken a huge interest into this and wanted to see this go through. Also, Senator Frederick.
Got it.
Those are some folks that we also have other folks that we are talking to.
Okay.
We just wanted the opportunity to do this presentation so that it was all on all of yours radar going forward.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for Lamar? Thank you.
Is that different than LC 3068? What is?
Yes, we'll get to that one. It's a totally different one. 2430.
I can make
is
sure
number.
To send it to your offices as
Thank
well.
Thank you. That'd be helpful
to make sure that you have it.
That'd be great. Very good. Thank you. So that takes care of our last item on the agenda, with the exception of Representative Wisney. If you want to give us an update on. Not 3068, but 2062, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was two meetings ago, the chair was not here, and he talked to me, and we really need to do something to continue the OER program. And so I agreed to draft something, get it started. I submitted a draft, which you have, which is not the current. You have the 10-4-16, Patrick. I apologize. There's a new one that's dated December the 5th, 16th, that came for some changes. It's still not where I want it. I'm going to continue to work on that. I'm meeting with this week. We'll be meeting with some people from the universities and also with Ben Cannon's office. I'm fine to make it a committee bill, except the fact that I don't know if I'm going to be on this committee.
Or whether this committee will exist.
Yeah, I understand that's another issue. So at this time, and I talked to Patrick, I'm going to go ahead and continue to work it as an individual, and any committee members that are still here with us. So we're losing a couple of our valuable members. I'll be glad to have you sign on and we get this thing done. We want to continue it. I think in the budget crunch, it's going to be hard to get another $700,000. But what I'm concerned about, and I think this chair, when he asked me to look at continuing this, is we want to continue the program once the money's available, because we don't want to just stop on what we've done so far. So that's what I'm working on with the HEC and university reps. That's where we are. Also, just unless there's questions about that, I'll be sure and send the Patrick. Last Thursday, I attended a CSG and CSL meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia. We did a report on. I was on the task force that's been meeting for the last year, and looking at employment of people with disabilities. And we came up with an interesting national report, which I'll be using that report to at least draft one bill or something. I said I'm probably going to be embarrassed. It'll be establishing a task force to study the task force to see where we are. But that's the best I could come up with this short time.
Bills, perhaps. Yeah.
So thank you. And look forward to, I think we all agree that the Open Education Resources is a program we want to keep going.
Yes.
And this may be a bad year for financing it, but we're going to keep pushing it. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that effort very much. And if I can be helpful, obviously you know where to find me. So that then we'll head to the work session, and we're going to introduce hopefully one bill or concept as a committee bill. So I'm going to open that work session. Representative Wiz, if you're willing to make the motion, I'll make a comment about it after that.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 3068, dated 12/6/16, be introduced as committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Wiz has moved legislative concept 3068, dated 12/6/16, be introduced as a committee bill. You may remember near the end of the last session, the Alliance of Independent Colleges, I know that the name escapes me at the moment, the new name, asked us to move quickly and do a bill that amended the process by which complaints were dealt with. That was necessitated by some federal action. It appears that we didn't quite get it right. So this, without going into too much more detail, unless people want it, I'm looking to see if Cindy's in the room. She is not.
She was.
If we need it, we can get it. But essentially, this is to try to further refine and better hit the target of what we were trying to do last time. Is that a sufficient explanation for people?
Yes.
And Representative Wisnett correctly reminds me to make the disclaimer that your support of this motion to introduce it as a committee bill does not obligate you to support the bill when it comes to the legislature in any committee that may or may not exist
Thank
in the next
that.
Session. With that, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. We'll introduce 3068 as a committee bill. Thank you for that. And we don't have any others to do we, Patrick?
The only one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on introduction of committee bills. That completes our agenda. And more importantly, it completes Representative Gallegos. Service on this committee.
Yep.
For that, we thank you. It's that, also my last time, I think, handling again. So,
yeah, so two of us.
Mr. Chair, can you tell us if we're going to have this committee?
I would tell you if I knew, but I don't know. Surprisingly, the.
I'm meeting with the speaker today, so let's.
You can tell us. You can tell us.
We do.
Yeah, the speaker has, you know, surprisingly expressed less interest in my thoughts about. committees for the
you
next
control our money. She should listen.
No. Well,
I'd like to just say I want to thank everybody out here,
please.
Really, for making this committee as important as it has been. I think, you know, it's interesting that these committees are all sort of siloed, and yet we're all connected. We should be anyway. Certainly, we talk a lot here about K-12, about healthcare, housing, other issues that certainly lead into a healthy and educated workforce. And it seems to me that's the struggle we have in here is making those connections. And I just want to thank you for helping us make those connections. So thank you very much.
That's really well said. I've enjoyed being at the center of a lot of other things, too. And that's a tribute to all of you. So we could go on and on like this for a
yeah.
long time. But you've all got things to do. So you know where to find me. Thanks for everything. We're adjourned.
You told me.
Where to find me? Thanks for everything. We're adjourned.